Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is March 27, 1977, and this is my monthly audio letter number 22. Few things are certain in life, but one thing we can depend upon is that things are always changing. Today a flower blooms in all its glory. Tomorrow it will be withered and forgotten, leaving behind only a beautiful memory. Today a child at play scrapes a knee, and the whole world revolves around a mother's tender care. Tomorrow the knee will be healed, leaving behind only a lesson of caution and comfort. Today you and I pass through this world for a little while. Tomorrow we will not be seen, leaving behind only the legacy of our choices for good or evil. Last month, in audio letter number 21, I alerted you to the possibility that we may have already failed in our efforts to prevent Nuclear War I, which is drawing closer by the day. My question is not, can the war be stopped, but will it be stopped? There is nothing in this whole world that would please me so much as to be able to tell you, good news, we have prevented the war, we have won. And when I recorded monthly audio letter number 16 on September 25, 1976, it seemed as though I might soon be able to give you such good news. Public reaction to my audio letters number 14 and 15 for July and August 1976 had thwarted an attempted Soviet double-cross of the Rockefellers by means of underwater missiles along our coastlines, and it had produced a direct meeting between General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and myself. But then came the terrible reversals for America that I revealed the following month in audio letter number 17. And far too many of those who had pressed the government for action during August 1976 failed to follow through and support General Brown in his efforts to continue to protect our beloved country. Now, as a result, we have lost General Brown as an effective force for good. Now the job of stopping Nuclear War I is even harder. It can still be done. But will we do it? My deep hope is still that the answer is yes, otherwise I would not be speaking these words. I am doing all in my power to bring the truth to you. So long as I continue to have access to vital information that bears on your life and your well-being, I will feel a deep responsibility to communicate it to you. But then it becomes your responsibility to choose what you will do about it. I have made many suggestions of things you might do to help save our country. In December 1975, I even recorded an entire tape devoted to nothing else entitled What We Can Do to Save America. But all I can hope to do is open your mind as to what you as an individual can do. In this great nation of some 215 million individuals, every person is different. No two of us have the same set of abilities, the same opportunities, or the same avenues for possible action. There is no way that I, just one person, even with the help of my associates and information sources, can provide a simple cut-and-dried prescription for what to do. But I am convinced that scattered throughout America is all of the knowledge, all of the ability to organize, and all the resources necessary to save our beloved land, if we will but do it. My three topics for today are, topic number 1, how circumstances are proving the Rockefeller Soviet plans to destroy America. Topic number 2, President Carter's efforts to hurry up Nuclear War I. And topic number 3, how the Church is being used. Topic number one. For over 4 years now, I've been trying by every means at my disposal to alert the American people to the progress of far advanced plans to destroy our beloved country as we know it. We are seeing the final stages of a plan to create a worldwide dictatorship acted out before our very eyes, with ourselves ensnared as the victims. This commitment for a one-world government under the control of a super-wealthy elite was set in motion in the early years of the 20th century, using a small group of powerful tax-exempt foundations to coordinate and direct the program. This program of conquest long ago became so massive, so powerful, and so complex that the average citizen had no hope of grasping what was really going on. And the one-world plans were and are so evil that the normal person simply cannot believe they are real without overwhelming proof. But how are things like this proven? Such a long-range commitment is a sophisticated form of conspiracy. So, how are conspiracies exposed and proven? Well known in legal circles, and especially in the United States Department of Justice, are the words of Special Judge Advocate John A. Bingham during the trial of the conspirators involved in Abraham Lincoln's assassination. This trial took place in Washington, D.C. in 1865. Listen to Judge Bingham's words, and I quote, "A conspiracy is rarely, if ever, proven by positive testimony. When a crime of high magnitude is about to be perpetrated by a combination of individuals, they do not act openly, but covertly and secretly. The purpose formed is known only to those who enter into it. Unless one of the conspirators betray his companions and give evidence against them, their guilt can be proved only by circumstantial evidence. It is said by some writers on evidence that circumstances are stronger than positive proof. A witness swearing positively, it is said, may misapprehend the facts or swear falsely, but that circumstances cannot lie." Unquote. Judge Bingham's words may come as a surprise to you if you're not a lawyer. Contrary to the impression you may have received from fictional detective stories, circumstantial evidence can be very powerful indeed and has decided the outcome of vast numbers of court cases. Furthermore, it is the incriminating power of circumstances that makes any conspiracy most vulnerable to just one thing: exposure. If the plans of even the most powerful of conspirators are made public and put on record before the plans are executed, often the plans have to be abandoned. Because even if the conspirators succeed in carrying out their plans without being caught in the act, the circumstances that result from their criminal actions cannot be hidden, and the advance exposure of their plan then causes the finger of guilt to point straight at the conspirators. This is the principle I invoke every time I publicly reveal anything about the plans or actions of those who are conspiring to destroy America. As I have always tried to make clear, my purpose in exposing these criminal plans is to prevent them from being carried out. In this way, I share a common goal with my associates and the many sources who provide me with vital confidential information. The best achievements of intelligence gathering, like diplomacy, often lie in what did not happen, the crisis quietly deflected. And our efforts up to now have been partially successful in that regard. But the commitment for world domination that was forged over two generations ago has grown into an incredible monster with countless tentacles and tremendous momentum. As a result, the four Rockefeller brothers and their co-conspirators have found it impossible to completely cover their tracks even though many modifications in their detailed plans have been made. So a brief review of the circumstances that have been developing around us over the past years is very, very revealing. First, consider Nelson Rockefeller's unsuccessful attempt so far to become our unelected president and dictator by way of his 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution. On October 11, 1974, I recorded my first audiobook talking tape entitled How to Protect Yourself During the Coming Depression and Third World War. At that time, Rockefeller still had 2 months to go being confirmed as Vice President, but I revealed that if confirmed, Rockefeller intended to become President by June 1975. In June 1975, during a trip to Europe, President Ford suddenly began taking serious falls, once down an aircraft ramp, and persons close to him said he also looked pale and unsteady. The public was quickly fed stories about the trouble being an old knee injury from football, even though Ford's doctor stated flatly that his falls had nothing to do with his knees. The following month, in audio letter number 2, I relayed information I had been given to the effect that Ford's troubles had been caused by a powerful virus of unknown origin, which had been arrested successfully. The next month, I revealed in lectures and also in audiobook special tape number 1 that by September or thereabouts, we should know whether Nelson Rockefeller was to be stopped in his drive to seize the presidency. And on September 5, 1975, an alleged attempt on Ford's life was made by Lynette Fromm. But as I warned in audio letter number 4 that month, this was only a dress rehearsal intended to frighten Ford into resigning. But Ford refused to resign, and on September 22, 1975, a real attempt on Ford's life took place. During a visit to San Francisco, Ford became the target of Sarah Jane Moore, and it truly was only by the grace of God that he escaped injury. It had been planned for Ford, when he came out of the St. Francis Hotel, to cross the street and shake hands with people in the crowd, and there waited Sarah Jane Moore, standing exactly where Ford was supposed to enter the crowd, armed with a pistol she had bought with a Treasury agent by her side the previous day, and with her mind programmed for assassination by electronic programming techniques. But at the last moment, the assassination plan fell apart. A Secret Service agent told the President not to cross the street, so he headed straight for his limousine. At that, Sarah Jane Moore raised her gun to fire across the street at Ford, but her shot was deflected by another onlooker, a Vietnam veteran in a wheelchair. As it turned out, this was indeed the real turning point in Nelson Rockefeller's hopes for succeeding Gerry Ford as president. He ran through a series of additional backup plans, all of which my sources enabled me to reveal in advance in my monthly audio letters, and he failed for the time being. But he recently whispered to reporters as he left a White House awards ceremony, "I'll be back." And then there is Fort Knox. I recorded my first audio book tape in October 1974, less than 3 weeks after the so-called gold inspection visit to Fort Knox by 6 congressmen, a senator, and about 100 newsmen. Here was a perfect example of a case in which the true circumstances alone, namely the absence of the huge hoard of gold shown on Treasury and Federal Reserve books, would have been sufficient all by themselves to prove the existence of a tremendous financial conspiracy. Therefore, great care was taken by the Treasury Department to prevent these circumstances from being detected. Instead of an objective, honest inspection of the bullion depository at Fort Knox by independent gold experts, the Treasury substituted a public relations peep show involving people who had no way of knowing what they should look for. And while the public was loudly promised an independent audit by the General Accounting Office of Congress, the actual so-called audit committee consisted almost entirely of Treasury personnel. and the tiny audit report that was finally issued several months late presented no findings of fact, concluding only, quote, "We believe," unquote, "the gold is there." My associates and I have amassed mountains of evidence in connection with the Fort Knox gold scandal. This twin scandal involves not only the theft of America's monetary gold supply, but also the storage of leaking canisters of CIA super poison processed from radioactive plutonium-239. From time to time I have made portions of this evidence public, such as in Monthly Audio Letter No. 2 for July 1975. In that tape I was able to reveal the sworn statement of former Congressman Frank Shelf attesting to the constant flow of gold out of Fort Knox during the mid-60s and the unsatisfactory answers he received from the Treasury and the White House about what was going on. I also revealed that the official listing of gold shipments from Fort Knox omits major shipments. One example, of which we had photographs, took place on January 20, 1965. And in response to such a specific challenge, the Mint admitted the shipment had taken place. But the most important item about Fort Knox that was revealed in Audio Letter No. 2 was the secret Central Core Vault, a huge central gold storage vault whose existence was not revealed to the September 1974 visitors and was later denied in writing by then Treasury Secretary William Simon. Another interesting circumstance, because the Central Core Vault was described and confirmed for us and for Congressman Otis Pike by a former commanding officer of Fort Knox, General John L. Ryan, Jr. Both Simon's lie and General Ryan's confirmation are quoted in Monthly Audio Letter No. 8, January 1976. The Central Core Vault is the key to the whole Fort Knox scandal. The joint Rockefeller-Soviet program to conquer the world is so all-encompassing that many other aspects of it have been discussed too in the Monthly Audio Letter. But the most overriding issue of all now is the rapid approach of Nuclear War I on American soil. In my very first tape, recorded in October 1974, I explained the basic purposes for which the Rockefeller brothers were betraying America into nuclear war. I also revealed the target schedule for the war to begin, mid-1977 to mid-1978. Today, some of the details of the war plan have changed, and the economic and political scenarios being planned by the Rockefellers at that time, while still on track, are behind schedule. But of all Rockefeller plans, the one for nuclear war on America is most crucial, and as of now, the time schedule for war is still practically unchanged. For reasons I will explain in Topic No. 2, the Rockefeller brothers are straining all their resources to prevent a slippage in the timing of the war. In July 1975, Indira Gandhi clamped down on her own India in a manner that stunned the world. She was condemned most bitterly of all by the government of the United States. The following month, in Audio Letter No. 3, I told you what had actually happened in India. Despite all appearances, Indira Gandhi was trying to save India's freedom, not destroy it. What she had done was to smash a CIA project that had been underway for 5 years to take over India. In the same tape, I went on to reveal that the joint Rockefeller plans for war were being revised on India's account. The plan for nuclear war on American soil was put back on a back burner until India could be taken over by war in Asia. The target date for India to be attacked under the revised war plan was March 1977, this month. I also told you, quote, "The new plans do not involve hostilities on American soil as they stand right now. Keep in mind, though, that further changes can and probably will occur. In particular, should Indira Gandhi be toppled from power anytime soon, it may well enable the CIA to put the original takeover plans back on track, and that would restore the original plan for war on the United States, unquote. When I revealed these things 19 months ago, they probably seem remote and improbable to you. But by relaxing the emergency control she had imposed and holding election on March 21, 6 days ago, she lost. Tragically for not only India, but America as well. Once again, things are not what they seem to be. The CIA succeeded in toppling Indira Gandhi by subverting the free election she wanted for her people, and did so this very month, March 1977. This was the original target date for war on India in the plans I revealed 19 months ago. With India taken care of, neutralized for the moment, nuclear war won on American soil no longer faces any delay on India's account. In monthly audio letter number 6 for November 1975, I revealed the grand strategy for the huge Asian war that was to precede nuclear war on America. It called for hostilities to begin in the Middle East, with a severe provocation arranged to justify a limited nuclear strike from the Sinai Desert at Arab OPEC oil wells. This cutoff of oil supplies would cripple the heart of Europe and Africa, disable Japan, and force dictatorial measures such as gas rationing and other measures on the American people by executive orders, with all these being brought about more completely under the domination of the Rockefeller-Soviet alliance. But now India has been rendered easy prey for a complete takeover and has therefore dropped in priority. The war in the Middle East has been delayed several times. The most decisive failure in this regard occurred late in December 1975, when OPEC oil ministers were kidnapped in Vienna by terrorists in the pay of the CIA. Several were supposed to be killed, inflaming passions and leading to war, but the job was botched and they all escaped with their lives. This caused a tremendous slippage in the plans for war and conquest, and for bungling this top priority assignment, the CIA station chief in Athens, Richard Welch, was executed by the CIA itself, as I revealed in monthly audio letter number 8 for January 1976. In that same tape, I publicly revealed the super-secret White House merge directive. This directive requires that life in the United States be so altered that it can be comfortably merged with life in the Soviet Union. And it has been in existence since the days of Stalin. Such a way of life is totally alien to America. But today, under the puppetized administration of Jimmy Carter, the federal government is now openly run by aliens with alien philosophies. Our life is being merged with that of the Soviet Union. Even so, the greed and lust for power that motivates both the rulers of the Soviet Union and the real rulers of America today know no bounds. And as early as November 1975 in audio letter number 6, I began warning of the threat of a Soviet double-cross of the Rockefellers and their corporate socialist intimates here in America. By the spring of 1976, I reported that certain trustees of the Rockefeller-controlled major foundations were increasingly concerned that such a double-cross was brewing. But not so the Rockefeller brothers and their closest collaborators, because they have more faith in the Soviet Union than they do in America. Last summer, of course, the Soviet double-cross actually began. First, as I reported in monthly audio letter number 13 for June 1976, I received intelligence information that a nuclear weapon had been planted at Seal Harbor, Maine, between the summer homes of David and Nelson Rockefeller. Soon afterwards, I was notified that the Soviet Union was planting short-range nuclear missiles within our own territorial waters, ready for launch from undersea resting places upon remote control. We were in danger of an immediate Soviet nuclear surprise attack, not only here but worldwide, that would destroy all effective naval opposition to the Soviet Union and thereby guarantee Soviet victory. Thanks to the intelligence gap created by Henry Kissinger as Secretary of State, the information reaching me about the missiles was not reaching the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Intelligence sources informed me that the only way action could be brought about to save the situation was by making it a public issue. So that is what I did by means of AUDIO LETTERS 14 and 15 last summer, and it worked, as I recounted for you in AUDIO LETTER No. 16 for September 1976. But the four Rockefeller brothers long ago passed the point of no return. In spite of what has happened last summer, they are continuing with a joint program of conquest with the Soviet Union, trying to convince themselves that their long-time alliance is back on track, but at the same time they are trying to hurry up Nuclear War I, because in the Soviet-Rockefeller rivalry, time is now on the side of the Soviets. My friends, we are now surrounded by circumstances that prove the existence of a grand conspiracy to rob us of our freedom and even our very lives. It is up to each one of us to open our eyes and see these circumstances for what they really are before it is too late.